Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of New Books Network Podcast. My name is Lee Pierce, she, they pronouns, hostess with the mostest of the language and media and communications channels. I am very excited today to welcome Mary Pylon, who is the author of The Monopolists, Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game from Bloomsbury Press. The Monopolist is a sort of like a multi-layer, multi-generational, multi-character, unknown story of how Monopoly came into existence, how it's been reinvented in its history, not only by Parker Brothers and media outlets, but also the lost female originator of the game and a professor who spent their life trying to tell everyone about the true stories of the origins, which has failed, otherwise we wouldn't need the book. So most people think Monopoly was invented by an unemployed Pennsylvanian who sold his game to the Parker Brothers during the Great Depression in 1935, and then lived happily and richly ever after. But as Mary tells us, that story is not exactly true. Ralph Anspach, who is a professor who was fighting to sell his anti-Monopoly board game decades later, unearthed the real story, which traces back to Abraham Lincoln, the Quakers, and a forgotten feminist named Lizzie McGee, who invented her nearly identical landlord's game more than 30 years before Parker Brothers sold their version of Monopoly. Now, Lizzie's game was underpinned by morals that were the exact opposite of what Monopoly represents today, and it had been embraced by a constellation of left-wingers from the progressive era through the Great Depression, including members of Franklin Roosevelt's famed Brain Trust. It's a gripping story about corporate greed. It illuminates the cutthroat nature of American business over the last century. And it's an excellent read. It reads like a detective fiction told through real life winners and losers with different pictures of the game. And I'm really just excited to have Mary here to talk about a book that came out a couple years ago, but seems to keep rejuvenating itself just because of the lifelong interest in the board game. And then also all the things happening with anti-corporate trust, or actually more like pro-corporate trust. So Mary, thank you so much for coming to the podcast. Tell us about yourself and how did you come to write the book and what's been happening with it the last couple of years since it went into press?
Thanks so much for having me. So I'm a journalist, an author, screenwriter, kind of in that order. I write mostly about the worlds of sports and business. And The Monopolist came about back in 2009. I was on staff at the Wall Street Journal covering what I thought was the great recession of our lifetimes. turns out I was wrong. We were in for another doozy. But in 2009, a lot of us were looking back at the Great Depression in the 1930s. It was pretty common to be making comparisons and thinking about, you know, culturally, financially, what did that look like compared to now? So I was in an article, I honestly don't even remember what my original idea was, but I was going to mention in passing Monopoly was invented during the Great Depression. That was the story that was tucked into my family's game board. We played every Christmas. I grew up in Oregon, so there were a lot of rainy days. So we had a lot of time for board games. And I always loved the game. And I felt like an idiot because I was looking around and things weren't adding up. And the Journal, you know, bless them, is a place that every sentence has to be bulletproof. You have to be able to say to your editor exactly where you got everything. It was an amazing place to kind of bloom as a reporter and learn the craft for that reason. So I felt like an idiot because here we were writing about derivatives and securitization and these complex financial instruments, and I couldn't get a sentence about a board game right. And it was driving me crazy. So I did, I employed a reporting trick that a lot of people use, which is if you don't know something, you try and reach out to counterparties in litigation. If you're being sued by someone or you are suing them, you might know something. And I was just at my wit's end. So it was through that line of thinking that I came across Ralph Ansbach's lawsuit. He made a game called Anti-Monopoly. And the details at that point were unclear, but I was like, God, this case looks like it went on forever, but it wrapped up in the early 80s. And so here I was in 2009, like, I don't even know. I mean, you never know. It's always a shot in the dark when you reach out. But particularly this, you know, just felt like, oh, this is so not going to work. But nonetheless, I sent him an email through his website and I said, hey, I know this sounds crazy. My name is Mary. I'm a reporter at the Journal. I'm just trying to find out what the deal is with Monopoly. And he immediately got back to me. And he said, oh, I've waited years for someone to ask me this. It's written by a woman. And it was played extensively for 30 plus years. And I spent 10 years litigating this. And I went to the Supreme Court, and just that hatched open the whole story. And Ralph, you know, for that original Wall Street Journal story, and then later for the book, pointed me to all these documents, all of this evidence. But then as I kept reporting, it became clear that he was the reason for the story, like that we wouldn't know about any of this had he not had his own kind of crazy Monopoly story 40 years after. So that became the article, which became the book proposal, which became the book. And then five some odd years later, when the book came out, I was able, I mean, for a long time, everybody thought I was like this crazy board game conspiracy theorist. I mean, you go around New York City and people are like, what are you working on? You're like, I'm working on a book about a board game. And everyone's like, that's so crazy. Like, what's wrong with you? And now at least I feel like hand people like the thing I was working on and say, no, it's actually really, it's a crazy story. Here, read all about it.
Yeah, it's a great book. I mean, I will say, for being like a supposed like scholar, academic, I read pretty lowbrow stuff, like self-published fantasy on Amazon. And sometimes I shy away from what I think most people call like historical fiction or historical nonfiction, which is just telling this story of the truth over years and years and years, because this is a long time span. I mean, this book spans like almost two centuries. But this reads, it does read like a detective story, and it's got multiple characters and they crisscross. And I was thinking it would actually make a really good like BBC miniseries where you do each mm-hmm. person's like timeline. So do you want to give us a layout of the major players, pun intended, and then how each one of them came at this from a different angle to converge into what we now know as the Monopoly game? And then maybe just highlight some of your favorite anecdotes or surprising things that you discovered along the way, because it's a lot of book that everyone really needs to go read. But I think you can give us like the big flavors of the,
sure.
piece.
I had this moment of terror that I think a lot of authors do, where I sold the proposal and I was so excited. And I was like, wait a minute, I don't know how to write a book. At that point, I'd only written, I think the longest thing I'd written was an article that was like maybe 2000 words. So
oh, this was your first book?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I was
terrified. That's crazy.
But I love, you know, it's funny you mentioned like beach reads. I'm an impassioned defender of beach reads, actually. I think that like, as long as people are reading, and I love reading as an escape, and I'm all for, you know, expanding our palette. That said, I also believe you should write what you want to read or what you do read. And I love narrative nonfiction. For this book, I was really inspired by the Eric Larsons of the world. I think I've read everything he's done. And he ended up blurbing the book, which was like, felt like a dream come true. Everyone has their rock stars. And I was like, Eric Larson's blurbing my book. Oh my God. I love the work of Gay Talese. I love The Billionaire's Vinegar is a book I looked at, which is traces the history of the most expensive bottle of wine. And I similarly was, you know, when you're doing day-to-day journalism, your characters are there, you know, they're, you pick up the phone and you kind of, you know, most news articles are pretty clearly structured. I actually take comfort in that formula. With a book, it's a whole different ballgame, because your characters, you have to spend so much time with them as a reader too. So with these characters, I knew, like Ralph, you know, bless him again, was so generous in terms of giving me time to spend with him and documents. And so over time, I got to know who Ralph was. I felt like I started to know the guy. I interviewed his sons and his wife, who has since passed. And so I knew the Ansbach family over time. And I felt like that was very similar to the work of journalism I was doing. However, Lizzie McGee, you know, I guess I'll just talk about the characters in chronological order. The first pass of the book, I realized I had to go back and rewrite it because I was so obsessed with trying to stitch together the dates and the places and the facts that I realized I didn't actually know who this woman was. I didn't have a sense of who she was as a person. I didn't know what it meant to be a woman doing this stuff in that time period. I'm not a scholar of feminist history. So I had to go back and really shape things out a bit more. And she's really the pulse of the book. Lizzie McGee was this pretty incredible woman. She was the daughter of this man named James McGee, who was one of the early founders of the Republican Party. He had traveled with Abraham Lincoln during the Lincoln-Douglas debates. He was a very influential newspaper owner, and he really infuses a lot of his political and economic values in his daughter. Lizzie McGee was this impassioned suffragette. She did some pretty audacious things in terms of advocating for women's rights. She placed an ad in a newspaper selling herself as a slave as a way to make a commentary about equal pay. She was involved in the theater. She wrote books of poetry, and she was a game designer. And she used games to as a teaching tool, which is really fascinating to me because now there's this really wonderful movement in education of bringing game design principles into engaging kids in learning. But the idea of a century ago doing that, you know, it's one thing to read about single tax theory, which, you know, just even saying that makes my eyes glaze over. And I love reporting on taxes. But for most people, it's a barrier. So the idea of her creating this game, the landlord's game, to teach and get her ideas across is pretty revolutionary. So she's the main character. We wouldn't have Monopoly if not for her. And then you have Ralph Ansbach. So Ralph, what I love about this story is you have two people who never meet and their fates are completely hinged on each other. Lizzie's story wouldn't have come out if not for Ralph Ansbach's work, but Ralph needed to prove Lizzie McGee's story to help defend his lawsuit and his case that he had a right to make his anti-monopoly game. So Ralph was this professor in the Bay Area in the early 1970s, married, two sons, and he was trying to create a game that could teach his students and his kids a kind of more morally righteous, more righteous version of Monopoly. When you think about where the country was in the early 1970s, there was a lot of cynicism. There was a lot of, you know, the OPEC oil cartels, for example, were, you know, making headlines every other day. And so he goes out to create this more philosophically pleasing version of Monopoly, which when you think about Monopoly, you know, it's a pretty dark game in some ways because it teaches kids, you know, that you have to clobber each other and only one person can win. And personally, I believe the pie of success is large and a lot of people can have slices. So he creates this game and it's not long before he gets a cease and desist letter from Parker Brothers saying that he can't make his game. And he thinks, wait, how can they have a monopoly? And that kicks off this 10-year-long legal battle and his detective story to find out the truth about the game. So he's really, you know, kind of main character too. And then I guess the other big character is Charles Darrow, who is the man who had sold a version of the game to Parker Brothers in the 1930s and was really held up as this Horatio Alger story, this brilliant inventor, when the game, by all evidence, had been around for 30 some odd years. And then I guess the other characters that I was really interested in were the Parker Brothers. Here's this family-run company that hits the Great Depression, and they need a hit, and they need it fast. And they start manufacturing Monopoly sets in the 1930s, and the game sells in a way that no game had really sold before it. And that's so counterintuitive in some ways, because it's the Great Depression, people are not spending a lot of money, and it's a game about swapping money and real estate. Although I argue in the book that I think that's precisely why the game was a huge hit.
Yeah, you say it's like a fantasy structure coping mechanism, essentially, right?
Definitely. And I think that's true for games today too. And I think that's a great thing. You know, I love theater. I love movies. I'm all, you know, to the point of beach reads. Like, I think escapism is great. And I think there's something really magical and wonderful about that. And it's interesting, when I was on the book tour, I heard a lot from parents who would say, oh, I'm using Monopoly to teach my kids about money because they don't know how cash works. So it's amazing how it's kind of come full circle.
Yeah, it's also interesting how the characters sort of mirror different ideologies, so to speak. So the story of Lizzie is very much about ethics and teaching and resistance and just like the long process of creating something that ultimately doesn't necessarily go anywhere. And it's not a surprise to me that the narrative we've latched on is this rags to riches, overnight success like Darrow, right? It's like, it's not surprising to me that that's the one that serves the ideological interest, because even though I love Lizzie's story, I can see why it's not the one that was sellable, right? So it's cool to see these all playing, intersecting each other, crisscrossing. And so the book's a great read. I mean, it does read very much like a detective story.
Oh, thank you. I love detective stories, and I read a lot of French. Yeah. Putting this together.
I'm an Agatha Christie, diehard Agatha Christie fan. So
yes, absolutely. So, but that's also what the true story was, you know, with Ralph in the 70s, he was traveling around the country trying to find these original players to give depositions and their boards and evidence to get the story right. So for me coming along in 2009, 10, 11, it was like another generation had passed. And so those depositions were absolutely critical for me and recreating the story. So he was a Monopoly detective, and that is also just what happened. So I kind of structured it that way after spending all this time with Ralph. And one of the things with Lizzie that, you know, I had this question too, that you're bringing up of like, why did the Darrow story cling? And I think part of it, even though it's not true and there was so much evidence flying in the face of it, I think it's because it's a really compelling story. Like, we love the idea in business, but also just in America, of more generally, of I'm going to go into my basement and I'm going to have a eureka moment and I'm going to innovate and boom, I'm going to become a millionaire. But I think most people would tell you that that's not how it works. Often is things are a slog and it takes a lot of hard work and a lot of trial and error. And I'm in the camp of thank goodness, because I wasn't born a genius. I don't have a like I like the idea of, you know, the incremental approach to innovation, and that it doesn't have to be perfect and we don't have to sit around and wait for lightning bolts. And the truth about innovation is it's really messy. And part of the reason why Monopoly is so good is that people tinkered with it for 20 or 30 years. What I couldn't have predicted is that there is a Horatio Alger, but it's Lizzie McGee, and that she created this game. And when you go back to these depositions and how she was talked about and covered in the 1930s, when this was, you know, Parker Brothers is selling the game, Darrow is propped up as the inventor, and she lashes out in the press. And she now is an older woman living in Washington, D.C., and she's holding up her boards, and she has two patents, and fewer than 1% of patents went to women at the time. So it's incredible to me.
Wow.
Got to a patent office in 1904. She renewed it in 1924, and she used her initials, interestingly. So you really have to know what you're looking for, but it's there it is, you know, E.M. McGee. And she lashes out. And at the time, you know, there's a deposition from Robert Barton, who is at the time one of the heads of Parker Brothers. And he kind of casts her as this like political wingnut, you know, that she's just kind of eccentric and she's kind of loopy. And she's so, you know, she's kind of out there. And by then, you know, Henry George, who was really her political guru, he had long since died, although he was hugely popular when he was alive. You know, she gets kind of cast aside. And one of the things I couldn't have predicted is I published, you know, this book came out in early 2015, and it found this really wonderful audience with women in tech. And then it got this whole other boost with the Me Too movement. You know, that used to me has become this example of all these other women who literally get written out of history, who make these huge contributions. I mean, obviously, when I was working on this, I had no idea that our culture would shift so much on this. My goal was just to tell the story and to get it right. And so it's interesting that now, you know, a couple years ago, Hasbro released a Ms. Monopoly game. And at first I was so excited because I thought, oh my gosh, this is the moment. Like, after a century, Lizzie McGee is going to get acknowledged. And I was crestfallen to find out that that wasn't the case. But what was amazing to me is the internet corrected the story. That people, because the book had been out for so long and picked up by so many news outlets, that Lizzie had all these advocates where immediately people were saying to Hasbro on Twitter, on social media, and all of the coverage it got in the Washington Post, New York Times, et cetera. Like, my phone was blowing up because people said, how could they do this? Lizzie McGee invented it. And I thought it was amazing that anybody noticed or cared. And so that the record was being reset. And I couldn't have foreseen Lizzie McGee really gaining traction as this kind of feminist anti-hero, which is, you know, it's better late than never, right? She died in 1948, but is getting the credit now in 2021.
Yeah. It's sad and heartwarming at the same time. I didn't know that there'd been this ups. I did kind of wonder, it was one of the questions I was going to ask you, like, so once you brought attention to this, did Lizzie McGee, and apparently she got her moment, good old social media.
she did get her moment, and she did and she didn't, right? Because
right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I love, so this is like a storytelling choice that, you know, and I'm saying this sitting in Los Angeles, right? So here, obviously, people love Hollywood endings. People love the, you know, it's all tied up in a bow, and there's a, you know, that's a formula for a reason, that it's very satisfying. It's like finishing a great meal when you finish a book or a movie that ends that way. I'm very different in that I like a gray. I like ending on a note that's complicated. I like leaning into that. I like ambiguity. I like reading it. I like, you know, leaning into that if that's what my reporting is yielding out. And so Lizzie McGee, when she dies in 1948, is not credited as the inventor at all. If you look at her obituary, it's like very hard to find. It's like a few little tiny lines. And she, the best we can tell, made $500 from inventing Monopoly. And one of the last traces of her that I was able to find is the 1940 U.S. Census, which had gotten digitized by the time I was reporting this. And it's really interesting because it shows she wore so many hats. You know, she had worked as a receptionist. She had been a teacher. She had been an actress. And her, when they ask you to list your occupation, she wrote game maker, which I thought was fascinating because that was the thing that she was clinging to as her identity, as what she really saw her job being, and her income is zero. So, you know, at the time, this was just right after the real first spike in Monopoly sales. And so here she is holding on to this. And years later, in Ralph's lawsuit, he started getting letters from people as his lawsuit was getting press who said, I worked with this woman. She was like the secretary at the Department of Ed, or she also worked at the post office at one point. And she said she invented Monopoly, and we all thought she was crazy. And Ralph was like, oh my God, you know, she was, that's what the facts bear out. So in her lifetime, I think it is a sad ending, but I think you know, there's kind of this weird relationship you have when you write history that, and this is gonna sound strange, but I don't think when people are dead, they're gone. You know, when people are dead, that doesn't mean they stop. They weren't ever on this planet. They weren't ever human beings. They weren't ever, you know, that they're really actually gone. And I don't mean that in a totally insane, you know, religious, metaphysical sense. I mean, like, she made a thing that we're still using today. And I love the idea of, like, kind of the red violin, or that these objects pass through time and pass through hands, and that it's all kind of a build. And, you know, I think one of the reasons, some of the feedback I got from why Lizzie McGee's story has really taken off with women and game design in particular is because, like, I think North Stars are really important. I think it's really important to know that you're part of a lineage that, you know, and I say this as a woman who writes about sports, like, I love when I find out about women who were doing sports journalism before, because they, if not for them, I couldn't do what I do, whether I know their name or not. So I really enjoy that. And I really enjoyed that about researching this book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, so that actually leads us to a really good question, which is, so there are these characters, but the board game itself is also a character. So you include different designs. It was circular at one point. You also talk about how people would play it in their homes. And so especially toward the like end of the 1800s, early 1900s, before Parker Brothers got their sort of like copyright on it, it would evolve and be kind of like a word of mouth kind of thing. And in fact, I think you even mentioned that there was a neighbor or someone who had played it and were like mad when Darrow copyrighted it because they had taught him the game. So could you talk about sort of some of the themes of the board game's evolution and some of the differences and similarities you see in its different iterations compared to maybe what people see now? Like, Were some things always there, even with Lizzie's version, or was she like on the opposite side of an arrangement versus what we might play now? And so can you lay some of that out for us?
Sure. The early evolution of Monopoly is fascinating, and it's neat too, because it's a very visual story. So if you look at Lizzie's 1904 patent, which is public and available, you see the core of our Monopoly board today. But it's 1904. So instead of free parking, because cars weren't really as big of a deal, you have free park. And she's really interested in land use, right? So that makes sense. She's also very concerned about the robber barons, the railroad robber barons. So you see the railroads, which we also have on our Monopoly board today. Excuse me. So she creates this game. And as it spreads throughout the Northeast, it's a folk game. So people modify the game and make it their own, and they localize it. So if you're playing in New York, you're going to have Broadway on there. If you're playing in Chicago, you're going to have the Loop. If you're in Boston, you might have the Commons. And I think that's one of the coolest things about looking at these early games is that they are so homegrown and that people really made it their own. And one of the groups that, and so I should back up. When she invents her game, she has two rule sets. She has a monopolist rule set, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's all about taking control of the board. And she has an anti-monopolist rule set, which is, you know, she's trying to teach people about the evils of monopolies. It's the monopolist rule set that takes off by all accounts, which is fascinating to me too, as a window into human nature, that when given the option of being good or evil, we all chose to like do the more vicious one. So one of the groups that really latches onto the game are the Quakers in Atlantic City. Atlantic City, I had so much fun. I was living in New York at the time, and I would spend a lot of time looking at the archives there. Atlantic City is this really incredible place in American history at this point. And Bryant Simon has written and researched a lot on this. I think his work is so excellent, because it reflects New York City and Philadelphia at the time, which is to say it's a total mix of immigrants, of, it's the birth of the hotel industry. There's a lot going on there. So the Quakers, at the time, it's funny because we think of Monopoly as being this like very milquetoast, wholesome, you know, it's a board game, right? But anything with a dice was considered to be... okay.
My cat just did a full-on... full-on Superman dive into the computer. No worries. He's like 300 pounds. Go ahead. Clearly, they have decided that today is their day and not my day.
They thought anything with a dice was considered to be evil. So they thought Monopoly was really scandalous. So they would have these Monopoly nights, and they put Atlantic City properties onto the board, just like everybody was doing. You made it look like your neighborhood. A lot of the early Atlantic City Quaker players were also teachers. So they, added some features to make it a little bit simpler so that they could play it with kids. So one of the early players of the Atlantic City game, so by now we're in the late 1920s, early 1930s, is a man named Charles Todd. And he plays the game and teaches it to Charles Darrow. They had a Monopoly night, just as was the fashion. And it's a version of that game that Darrow sells to Parker Brothers. And then years later, when Ralph was going through his lawsuit, he tracks down Charles Todd and his wife Olive, who were there for the Monopoly night, and they give a deposition and they say this is exactly what happened, and it actually ruined their friendship, that the Darrows and the Todds never really spoke after. So that was a big linchpin in his case. And for me, when I was thinking about the timeline of the game and kind of this question of like what happened, Charles Todd's a big part of that.
So what's your opinion of Darrow? Because you sort of like, you're clearly a fan of Lizzie. And Darrow, you sort of slow roll a little bit. Like, you present the facts and the arguments and stuff, but I can't really tell if you think he's a scumbag or an opportunist, or like, who is he? What character is he for you?
Again, I lean into the gray. Ralph, I don't know if I included this in the book or not, but Ralph once used the phrase benevolent con man.
Oh, that's great.
Really interesting. So, Darrow, like, look, this is the Great Depression, right? And Darrow, he wins the lottery effectively, and he has a family he's supporting, and he has a son who is dealing with some disabilities and things, which at that time would have been absolutely horrible in terms of what your options for, schooling and education and things would have been like. So this really big part of me was really like, there's a lot to be empathetic with there. And I think it's dangerous to just cast someone as a villain right off the bat.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a little more complicated. And, you know, there's also this question, and then this is what's so frustrating about writing about the deceased, is like, what did he know and how much of it did he know? I don't know. You know, like right. There's a lot of like, there's, we just don't know. So that's why I'm a little reluctant to, you know, to cast him as anything in particular. I think the other big part of the story, and I think that the Darrow opinion kind of falls into this for me, is that we have to remember nobody knew they were sitting on Monopoly. You know, we're sitting here talking about the game forever after, but no one, I mean, a hit in the board game industry was so unusual, but the idea of one that you would create, you know, like that you would play generation after generation after generation that was commercially sold. I mean, obviously we have checkers and chess and Parcheesi and these other games, but this was insane. Nobody knew that it was going to be as gangbusters of a seller either. So that also raises questions too, is like, yeah, we're sitting here saying like, how could he have taken credit for a game that, you know, was making millions? And I don't think he knew that at the time. Who could have? I don't know if Barden or Parker Brothers knew that this game was going to become such an icon. So I don't know. I think he's a tricky character, but I don't get the sense that he was, you know, I went back and read all of the press and stuff that he did at the time. And it's not like he's like screaming at Lizzie McGee as being this horrible person or anything. She's not addressed, right? She's just not.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, at one point Ralph finds these letters that I include in the book where Barton, the CEO of Parker Brothers, asks Darrow, you know, hey, we have a chance. Can you write up a history of the game? Because people are asking questions. And he dodges the question and he kind of writes back this fumbling, like, you know, oh, I don't really remember. And I think that that's kind of indicative of how he felt about it, that this was keeping his family afloat. And I thought that was really interesting too. And, you know, researching him, that I think that's a very primal thing that is really understandable. And in a way, in a funny way, that's what Ralph was trying to do. Ralph was trying to make his game and teach his kids a lesson about right and wrong. So in a funny way, I think that there's some like, it's always interesting to, you want to look at what conflicts exist when you're writing a story, but there's also a lot to be said for looking at what people have in common. And I think that that's something that, you know, the theme of fatherhood, I thought was really interesting in this story too.
Yeah. And I think what's cool about Darrow, because you know, I'm a rhetorician, right? So I always read people as symbols kind of thing. And so it's less about whether Darrow's the good guy or the bad guy. It's like Darrow as a character really gives the lie to the myth of like capitalist success, because he really did just stumble on a lot of work that had been done by other people over many like disparate people and centuries and games, right? He just happened to be in the right place at the right time to bring those together and then stumbled into the right period. And also, you know, probably being a white man pitching the board game helped. And so it isn't that he's not deserving of his success. It's that he is just the tip of a success iceberg. And so when we look at these people like the Darrows and the Elon Musks and the Steve Jobs, I mean, they help shore up like a support for Monopoly now. Cause I mean, you're seeing like these trusts and monopolies happening all over the place. And that's why Darrow's cool, is because his success with the game is precisely how people imagine that stuff to work. And yet when you dig into the details, it isn't how it works. It's not that he's a bad or good. He just is the mythological figure of like, he just came up with it one day and then he was the right person to market. And then when you look at the details, you're like, nope, really just right place, right time.
Absolutely.
With a little bit of like, he just put the English on it, as the billiards players say.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, zooming out, you have to think about not just these people in the story, but the systems in which they're operating.
Right. Yeah.
And the same way I had to go back and think about Lizzie McGee, like what was the system she was operating in? Okay, the head of the U.S. Patent Office says publicly, women, don't even bother applying. We're not going to approve you. But the system in which Darrow was operating, you know, to your point, was the domain of, you know, wealthy, rich white men. Like, so,
yeah.
We could have a whole separate conversation about cancel culture and rewriting history. And, you know, that's all fine and good. I think that that's also part of the story too, that, you know, and I was looking at this with very different eyes, but I think that part of the reason, and I read about this in the book, but like part of the reason I wanted to tell this story is I think history is full of Lizzie McGee's. I think it's full of women. And I mean, there are a long list of categories of people who literally get written out of the story, but are hustling, you know, they do a lot of work. And I think that that's, that's the story of this country. That's the story of how things have been built. And it's not that there aren't women doing incredible things. It's that we just haven't told their stories, or their story, you know, or certain groups have only told their stories. And the funny thing about the Me Too movement to me is, among my female friends, there was this whole thread of conversation that I think a lot of people had, which is like, where's everyone been? You know, like, this is news to people that, like, you know, that women are struggling, and that there is these, you know, we're ignored, we're talked over, we're mansplained. Like, it, you know, people, women have been talking about this for a long time. So it's interesting that, you know, things kind of pop through in these moments. And, you know, with the pandemic in particular, I'm really curious what this next wave of feminism is going to look like, because the jobs numbers have really, really grossly, like, horribly impacted women. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, childcare duties and caregiving, how that's fallen on women. And, you know, I think about Lizzie McGee in that sense, too, that she, there's this optimism in what she did. And I think that creating something is an act of, it can be an act of rebellion, but it also can be a way of asserting yourself. And the fact that I'm blown away that I even had enough documentation to tell her story, given the hurdles and the barriers that she had. And yet, you know, here there's Darrow, who didn't have any evidence, and his story ran amok for decades, which I think tells you a lot right there.
Well, and you edited another collection, which is more about, like, sports culture. And it's like, the title of it is Losers. And I remember reading about that thinking there's some overlap here, because you don't, there's like a couple different kinds of ways to do this, right? First, you can tell the story where Lizzie's the hero who got a, you can make like a biopic and she just got a dumb run of luck and like, but you center her. You can decenter her as just part of a mythology. Or you can tell the story that I think you told, which is like, she kind of lost, like, but you're not trying to turn that into some type of virtue. It isn't like, you're not like, there's not like this martyrdom that we should praise her because she lost. It's just, the reality is that this is a common story for minoritized people, that they do all of this work and they are the creators, and then it just doesn't pan out for them. So I'm excited to read the edited volume too, because I like this threat. Because you think about Malcolm Gladwell, he wrote this book about, I forget what it's called, but it's like, here are how all the losers really are the winners. But that's not what this is. It's like, yes, you lost.
Yeah, like, definitely.
That's just what happened.
So Louisa Thomas, my colleague at The New Yorker, who I did Losers with, this very much came out of our conversations about this, that in our just lives, loss has played a huge role. You know, whether that's a breakup, a loss of a job, a loss of someone we loved, loss is a defining thing. And I don't think that's unique to the two of us. I think it's a universal thing. And in our travels, particularly writing about sports, and we write about this in the introduction of the book, if you go to the locker rooms of the losers, it's weird. You know, it feels uncomfortable. And to lose so publicly in sports, which is like kind of a unique experience, or can be. And we were like, why are people so, especially in sports, so freaked out about talking about loss, when on some level we all acknowledge it's something that we go through? And one of the reasons I love writing about sports is people, I always say that it's like people think they're eating ice cream, but you can give them spinach. So every single one of the pieces in the collection is about sports. There's a bullfighting piece, there's baseball pieces, there's, you know, it's has the mask of sports, but it's also about psychology. It's about the different flavors of loss, the different things that happen. You know, it looks like a very almost funny kind of farcical light read. And it came out over the summer. So a lot of people I know read it, you know, on the beach, which is great. You know, I like that too. But there's also, we love every piece in this collection, because there's in every single one of them, like a darker, meatier underpinning to it too. And people are, I don't know, when people get really uncomfortable talking about something, I think part of me is like, ooh, there must be something there. Like, what's that about?
Yeah, let's go there right now. Yeah.
Yes. And I shared that too. We were like, oh, let's write a book only about losers. And also we were on a tear of, you see this with sports stories, like editors don't like writing loser stories. And anyone who's really great at sports, like we have a really fabulous piece in here about LeBron James as a loser. And at first, when the idea came in, I was like, I don't know, like, how can we have a LeBron piece in a collection called Losers? But Ryan O'Hanlon, who wrote that, did such a fantastic job of, you know, talking about LeBron's relationship with loss. And it's just this wonderful foil story. And I think that that's also true, that anyone who's really successful will have at least one, if not several, loser stories and how that changed things for them. So we think they're really instructive too. So always here for the losers, always.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things I liked about Monopoly. And then when I saw the new edited book, I was like, oh, this is like maybe one of your things is to tell the loser story without turning it into this, like, it was the moment right before they won. It's like, no, she never wins, right?
It's so really relatable, right? Like, I mean,
yeah, it really is.
Like, we've all been ignored. We've all been that person who has been completely steamrolled, or, you know, had a great idea that, like, we've all had something stolen from us. Like, there's every single character you're writing about, there's like a universal thing, right? With Ralph's lawsuit, we've always had fights. You've always had a struggle or something that you were trying to prove or put together. Or so I really try to find that in everything I can write. But again, losers, like, we've all lost. And I was a terrible athlete as a kid too. So I really, there's no metaphor. I was like, oh, yeah, I've been there. I know how that feels.
Yeah, well, and I think what's so frustrating about this book, and also makes it so fun to read, is like fun, like in the pain, like it's fun because it hurts kind of way, is that she cares so much, right? Lizzie just clearly and this is only what little I mean, I can only imagine what this book would like if you had any letters or anything else you could access. I think you'd find even more depth of passion and caring. And Ralph cares so much and is trying to do something so important. And then Darryl just like, da-dum, 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 stumbles into this and kind of this milquetoast evolution. And you're just so bummed out because it's like he's clearly the least invested. But you're right. He does have a different kind of investment, which is he's motivated by the need to survive and take care of his family. So I don't mean to say he's not like passionate. I just mean it doesn't seem like he really cares about the game. And so it does kind of blow a hole in this myth that, like, I always say it's graduation speech time is coming up. So 9 out of 10 speeches are going to be about don't do what, like, find your passion.
Yeah.
And that's why I love books like this, because it's like, yeah, or don't, because look what happened to the game of Monopoly. You know what I mean?
Right. Oh, yeah. It's fascinating how I think also in Silicon Valley now there's this interesting, like, preciousness around losing. And I'm like a big fan of self-pity, actually. I think sometimes when things are like, it's worth saying, this sucks.
Yeah.
This is bad. And that allows you to, like, you know, what's the expression? Like, name the pain, own the pain, be the pain, release the pain, or something like that. Like, I think that there's also this, like, oh, you know, my parents didn't give me money for my first company and it was really rough, but now I'm a billionaire. And you're like, wait a minute. Like, so I think that, like, loss, you know, and that's one of the things we don't know is what Lizzie McGee, like, how she felt about this. We know we have some indications and whiffs of it. But there's also a view that if her ultimate goal wasn't to make money, but to have people playing the game, then she was really successful, right? I mean, yeah, we are essentially still talking about this. Now, where it gets tricky for me is, if you pulled somebody off the street and said, oh, Monopoly, I don't think they would say, oh, yeah, that single tax game that teaches people about the evils of capitalism, right? So some of the message, I think, got lost in translation, but people are playing her game. Like, her game is really out there and has had this life beyond what I think she could have ever imagined. So it's been fascinating for me in the years since the book has come out that I get letters on both sides of it, which to me is gratifying because it makes me feel like I maybe did a good job of of keeping it in a gray space. Because the truth is, I don't know. You know, I feel like my opinion on this has changed too.
Well, and you can't discount that, just like you said at the beginning of the interview, the need for this game to perform a certain kind of function at different times when people's lives have been very hard. And not to shit on people because they needed a little bit of an escape. And I think you do a great job of keeping that in sight throughout the book.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I say this as somebody who loves games and loves playing games too. So, you know, that always puts you in a weird space as a journalist too, because you want to get the facts straight and you want to be fair. But you also want to try and be in people's heads and you want to try and think, and books are also such a different game than, oh, that was a terrible pun, than articles, because you have to think about them lasting for a lot longer and they're not always more evergreen, but I have a lot of friends and colleagues who do these really newsy, quick turnaround books, and that's great. And I like reading them. I don't know if I could totally do that because I kind of like, I like that most of the story happened at least 30 or 40 years ago. So there were, even Ralph was at a different place with it by the time I was talking about it because he could kind of reflect on it differently. So as far as a memory exercise, I thought that was interesting too. And that's true for the game as well. I mean, I still play with my family. I still really enjoy it.
Yeah, but no, my family was not allowed to play Monopoly. We had a very different relationship to it.
Yeah. And I lose, by the way. And my family still argues with me about the rules. So let it be known, you can spend 5 or 6 years of your life writing a book about it and you're still the little sister. It's like,
that's very funny. Do you explain to them that the original version had two versions of rules? Because I love that about design.
For the Times that you can find on my website about how most people don't play by the proper rules. I mean, it's a tiny little beat, but I guess it's one that I'm trying to own. So that's like also funny too to me that, you know, one of the things I love about games, both playing with my family and friends, is that we see different sides of people. You know, my grandmother, who is this tiny, petite, church-going, sweet lady, turns into an animal when you play Monopoly with her. Like, she steals, this was before smartphones when we played as a kid. And so you didn't get up to go to the bathroom because Grandma Maxine might rip you off. Like, it was a real, she was a different person. And I always think that's super fun to see emerge.
Well, and thinking about the book as having a longer life than its immediate life, what I found interesting since I read the book, which at this point has been a couple of months, is that now when I see Monopoly show up as like a signifier in culture, I'm a lot more attentive to it. And the reason I think of it right now is because the pilot came out for this new, like kind of like stupid sitcom called Home Economics on Hulu. I don't know what station it's on, Fox or whatever. I stream everything. I'm a millennial. And so in the first episode, you meet all the characters and they're all in various forms of like economic struggle, right? That's kind of, and the older brother who's sort of a schmooze is like filthy rich and stupid. And it's like, he's like one of those characters that is frustrating and I can't imagine is real because he's so stupid and so rich. It makes me very angry. But there's a scene in the middle of it where the kids are playing Monopoly kind of haphazardly and it's the cousins and they're bonding and he shows up and starts lecturing them about how to play the game to like maximize profits. And he's criticizing the one kid because he's not diversifying and all this stuff. And I was like, you know, this is such a great scene because he's so unlikable and he's the one coming in and ruining the fun of the game with all of the like profit motives. And yet also he's reinforcing the idea that this is what we should all be. And it's a really short scene. It's only about 10, 15 seconds. I had all of these thoughts about it because I had so much context from the book. So I'm excited. I'm excited to see how this pops up in my life.
I love that. There's also a fabulous Sopranos Monopoly scene. Also a great Monopoly scene in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh my gosh, I forgot about that. Oh, it'd be cool to go back and maybe this will be my next article is the rhetoric of Monopoly. And I can just use your book and look at Monopoly scenes.
Irony abounds. I was joking with my editor that, you know, I was like, there's going to be no puns in the prose of this book. Like no one's passing go. No one, like, I was like, I'm just going to keep it clean because like the book is so laced with irony. I don't need to hammer it home.
No.
You know, no one's going to jail. No one, like, we're just going to keep the language of the game out because it's already so in people's brains that
that's
any help from me on that at all.
Yeah, I appreciated that. This could have easily fell into obvious corny territory and you kept it really implicit. It's like, there was never a moment where you were hammering me over the head with the point. You just wrote it so well that I followed you the whole way. So, I mean, kudos on being an awesome writer. This was quite the read. So with that said, now that I'm ready to tell everyone where to buy the book, do you want to say anything else about main takeaways or what you're working on now? Or
sure. So I'm working on a bunch of stuff now that I don't know how much I can talk about, which sounds like I'm in the CIA or something. But it actually just means things are moving really slowly. Losers is out and is a blast. And it's just been fun. I mean, there's no way that Luis and I could have known when we sold the book that we would be launching it into a summer of no sports or a season where, you know, like losers, like 2020, what a theme for the year, loss, right? So it's been fun in a strange way to see that have kind of, you know, there was like this moment where there was like no sports content at all. And we were like, we got you covered. We got a whole collection of stuff about sports and losing. So working on that, and then I'm kind of continuing to report on the lack of sports, which is kind of an interesting, weird world. And then the Monopolis has also been in development as a film. So that's a thing on my plate.
What? Oh, my, so not my BBC miniseries, but it'd make a great film too.
Correct. But as you know, it's like you start out talking about one thing and then before you know it, you know, it's, I just keep joking that I want Meryl Streep to play all the parts. I want Meryl to do a one-woman play with Meryl.
That would actually be really fun to do the whole thing with one performer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Just all Meryl.
That's a good idea.
She what can't she do? So, yeah. You know, calls, you can tell I'm not the most helpful. I'm just like, how do I become
friends? Well, and I will. Yeah, I know. My whole goal was just how to become friends with Meryl Streep. That'll be your next book. Once yeah, it book finally happens.
That's actually what the subhead should be. The Monopolis. Mary Poulon's long con to friend.
Yeah. And with that said, I just want to remind the listeners as we wrap up that I've been talking to Mary Poulon, who is the author of The Monopolis, Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. And if you click on the show notes in the podcast or on the website, we'll link to Mary's website. That way, marypoulon.com. That way you can keep abreast of all of the Meryl Streep happenings and other books on the way. And just as a reminder, this is a book published by Bloomsbury, which is one of our favorite presses. They are they do excellent work. Authors like Mary do a ton of research to put these in people's hands. And right now, if I'm not mistaken, this book is like $8 on Kindle.
I believe so.
Oh, yeah. So just to be clear, like not raking in the dough on these books. So if you have a chance to pick up a copy, please do. But if, you know, if your appetite has been sated and you've had enough, the other really nice thing you can do, I think, especially for a book like this that clearly is going to have such a long life, is to pick up a hard copy and donate it to your local library. You can certainly put in a request for them to purchase it, but budgets are tight right now. And so a really awesome thing to do, especially with the underserved public libraries, is to buy a copy, a hard copy, and just take it by and donate it and let them put it on the shelves for people to enjoy. Because obviously the game isn't going away, and that means the book is going to continue to circulate and have new meaning and educate people about the way that these board games that we play have these very important ideological lives. And again, introducing people to the story of Lizzie McGee, which I was not aware of. So Mary, with that, I just want to say thanks for coming on. We're excited about everything that you're planning on doing. Anything else you want to say to the listeners before we say goodbye?
No, thanks so much for having me. And just to add to that, you're absolutely right. Shout out to Bloomsbury. They were awesome to work with this. Shout out to bookshop.org, which is how I've been buying pretty much all my books now. It's help support indie bookstores in your area. It's a great way to get the book as well. And shout out to libraries.
Yeah, for real, public libraries. We also work with an indie book. New Books Network also recently kind of like got away from Amazon and moved into some indie book publisher. And I wonder if it's the same one. I'm a bad host. I will find out. And from now on, I will follow your lead and shout out our independent booksellers. So thank you so much again, everyone, for listening. Head out and pick up a copy of The Monopolis, or let people that you think might be interested pick up a copy, or again, one for your library. And stay safe, mask up, and we will talk to you soon.